the way they did, elevated above the crowd, destined for greatness. Understand, it is within your power to set your own price. How you carry yourself reflects what you think of yourself. If you ask for little, shuffle your feet and lower your head, people will assume this reflects your character. But this behavior is not you. It is only how you have chosen to present yourself to other people. You can just as easily present the Columbus front, buoyancy, confidence, and the feeling that you were born to wear a crown. As Friedrich Nietzsche said, "With all great deceivers there is a noteworthy occurrence to which they owe their power. In the actual act of deception, they are overcome by belief in themselves. It is this which then speaks so miraculously and compellingly to those around them." Keys to Power. As children, we start our lives with great exuberance, expecting and demanding everything from the world. This generally carries over into our first forays into society as we begin our careers. But as we grow older, the rebuffs and failures we experience set up boundaries that only get firmer with time. Coming to expect less from the world, we accept limitations that are really self-imposed. We start to bow and scrape and apologize for even the simplest of requests. The solution to such a shrinking of horizons is to deliberately force ourselves in the opposite direction, to downplay the failures and ignore the limitations, to make ourselves demand and expect as much as the child. To accomplish this, we must use a particular strategy upon ourselves. Call it the strategy of the crown. The strategy of the crown is based on a simple chain of cause and effect. If we believe we are destined for great things, our belief will radiate outward, just as a crown creates an aura around a king. This outward radiance will infect the people around us, who will think we must have reasons to feel so confident. People who wear crowns seem to feel no inner sense of the limits to what they can ask for or what they can accomplish. This, too, radiates outward. Limits and boundaries disappear. Use the strategy of the crown, and you will be surprised how often it bears fruit. Take as an example those happy children who ask for whatever they want and get it. Their high expectations are their charm. Adults enjoy granting their wishes, just as Isabella enjoyed granting the wishes of Columbus. Throughout history, people of undistinguished birth, the Theodoras of Byzantium, the Columbuses, the Beethovens, the Disraelis, have managed to work the strategy of the crown, believing so firmly in their own greatness that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The trick is simple. Be overcome by your self-belief. Even while you know you are practicing a kind of deception on yourself, act like a king. You are likely to be treated as one. The crown may separate you from other people, but it is up to you to make that separation real. You have to act differently, demonstrating your distance from those around you. One way to emphasize your difference is to always act with dignity, no matter the circumstance. Louis Philippe gave no sense of being different from other people. He was the banker king. And the moment his subjects threatened him, he caved in. Everyone sensed this and pounced. Lacking regal dignity and firmness of purpose, Louis Philippe seemed an imposter, and the crown was easily toppled from his head. Regal bearing should not be confused with arrogance. Arrogance may seem the king's entitlement, but in fact it betrays insecurity. It is the very opposite of a royal demeanor. Haile Selassie, ruler of Ethiopia for 40 or so years beginning in 1930, was once a young man named Lij Tafari. He came from a noble family, but there was no real chance of him coming to power, for he was far down the line of succession from the king then on the throne, Menelik II. Nevertheless, from an early age he exhibited a self-confidence and a royal bearing that surprised everyone around him. At the age of 14, Tafari went to live at the court, where he immediately impressed Menelik and became his favorite. Tafari's grace under fire, his patience, and his calm self-assurance fascinated the king. The other young nobles, arrogant, blustery, and envious, would push this slight, bookish teenager around. But he never got angry. That would have been a sign of insecurity, to which he would not stoop. There were already people around him who felt he would someday rise to the top, for he acted as if he were already there. Years later, in 1936, when the Italian fascists had taken over Ethiopia, and Tafari, now called Haile Selassie, was in exile, he addressed the League of Nations to plead his country's case. The Italians in the audience heckled him with vulgar abuse, but he maintained his dignified pose as if completely unaffected. This elevated him, while making his opponents look even uglier. Dignity, in fact, is invariably the mask to assume under difficult circumstances. It is as if nothing can affect you, and you have all the time in the world to respond. This is an extremely powerful pose. A royal demeanor has other uses. Con artists have long known the value of an aristocratic front. It either disarms people and makes them less suspicious, or else it intimidates them and puts them on the defensive. And as Count Victor Lustig knew, once you put a sucker on the defensive, he is doomed. The con man Yellow Kid Wild, too, would often assume the trappings of a man of wealth, along with the nonchalance that goes with them. Alluding to some magical method of making money, he would stand aloof, like a king exuding confidence, as if he really were fabulously rich. The suckers would beg to be in on the con, to have a chance at the wealth that he so clearly displayed. Finally, to reinforce the inner psychological tricks involved in projecting a royal demeanor, there are outward strategies to help you create the effect. First, the Columbus strategy. Always make a bold demand. Set your price high and do not waver. Second, in a dignified way, go after the highest person in the building. This immediately puts you on the same plane as the chief executive you were attacking. It is the David and Goliath strategy. By choosing a great opponent, you create the appearance of greatness. Third, give a gift of some sort to those above you. This is the strategy of those who have a patron. By giving your patron a gift, you are essentially saying that the two of you are equal. It is the old con game of giving so that you can take. When the Renaissance writer Pietro Aretino wanted the Duke of Mantua as his next patron, he knew that if he was slavish and sycophantic, the Duke would think him unworthy. So he approached the Duke with gifts, in this case, paintings by the writer's good friend Titian. Accepting the gifts created a kind of equality between Duke and writer. The Duke was put at ease by the feeling that he was dealing with a man of his own aristocratic stamp. He funded Aretino generously. The gift strategy is subtle and brilliant because you do not beg. You ask for help in a dignified way that implies equality between two people, one of whom just happens to have more money. Remember, it is up to you to set your own price. Ask for less, and that is just what you'll get. Ask for more, however, and you send a signal that you are worth a king's ransom. Even those who turn you down respect you for your confidence, and that respect will eventually pay off in ways you cannot imagine. Reversal. The idea behind the assumption of regal confidence is to set yourself apart from other people. But if you take this too far, it will be your undoing. Never make the mistake of thinking that you elevate yourself by humiliating people. Also, it is never a good idea to loom too high above the crowd. You make an easy target. And there are times when an aristocratic pose is eminently dangerous. Charles I, King of England during the 1640s, faced a profound public disenchantment with the institution of monarchy. Revolts erupted throughout the country, led by Oliver Cromwell. Had Charles reacted to the times with insight, supporting reforms and making a show of sacrificing some of his power, history might have been different. Instead, he reverted to an even more regal pose, seeming outraged by the assault on his power and on the divine institution of monarchy. His stiff kingliness offended people and spurred on their revolts. And eventually Charles lost his head, literally. Understand, you are radiating confidence, not arrogance or disdain. Finally, it is true that you can sometimes find some power through affecting a kind of earthly vulgarity, which will prove amusing by its extremeness. But to the extent that you win this game by going beyond the limits, separating yourself from other people by appearing even more vulgar than they are, The game is dangerous. There will always be people more vulgar than you, and you will easily be replaced the following season by someone younger and worse. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Balthazar Gracian. Never lose your self-respect, nor be too familiar with yourself when you are alone. Let your integrity itself be your own standard of rectitude, and be more indebted to the severity of your own judgment of yourself than to all external precepts. Desist from unseemly conduct, rather out of respect for your own virtue than for the strictures of external authority. Come to hold yourself in awe, and you will have no need of Seneca's imaginary tutor. From the Histories by Herodotus. Hippoclides at Sicyon. In the next generation the family became much more famous than before through the distinction conferred upon it by Clisthenes, the master of Sicyon. Clisthenes had a daughter, Agoriste, whom he wished to marry to the best man in all Greece. So during the Olympic Games, in which he had himself won the chariot race, he had a public announcement made, to the effect that any Greek who thought himself good enough to become Clisthenes' son-in-law should present himself at Sicyon within 60 days, or sooner if he wished, because he intended, within the year following the 60th day, to betroth his daughter to her future husband. Clisthenes had had a racetrack and a wrestling ring specially made for his purpose, and presently the suitors began to arrive, every man of Greek nationality who had something to be proud of either in his country or in himself. Clisthenes began by asking each of the numerous suitors in turn to name his country and parentage. Then he kept them in his house for a year, to get to know them well, entering into conversation with them, sometimes singly, sometimes altogether, and testing each of them for his manly qualities and temper, education, and manners. But the most important test of all was their behavior at the dinner table. All this went on throughout their stay in Sicyon, and all the time he entertained them handsomely. For one reason or another, it was the two Athenians who impressed Clisthenes most favorably, and of the two, Tisander's son, Hippoclides, came to be preferred. At last the day came which had been fixed for the betrothal, and Clisthenes had to declare his choice. He marked the day by the sacrifice of 100 oxen, and then gave a great banquet, to which not only the suitors but everyone of note in Sicyon was invited. When dinner was over, the suitors began to compete with each other in music and in talking in company. In both these accomplishments, it was Hippoclides who proved by far the doughtiest champion. Until at last, as more and more wine was drunk, he asked the flute player to play him a tune and began to dance to it. Now it may well be that he danced to his own satisfaction. Clisthenes, however, who was watching the performance, began to have serious doubts about the whole business. Presently, after a brief pause, Hippoclides sent for a table. A table was brought, and Hippoclides, climbing onto it, danced first some Laconian dances, next some Attic ones, and ended by standing on his head and beating time with his legs in the air. The Laconian and Attic dances were bad enough. But Clisthenes, though he already loathed the thought of having a son-in-law like that, nevertheless restrained himself and managed to avoid an outburst. But when he saw Hippoclides beating time with his legs, he could bear it no longer. "Son of Tisander," he cried, "you have danced away your marriage." The 35th Law. Master the Art of Timing. Judgment. Never seem to be in a hurry. Hurrying betrays a lack of control over yourself and over time. Always seem patient, as if you know that everything will come to you eventually. Become a detective of the right moment. Sniff out the spirit of the times, the trends that will carry you to power. Learn to stand back when the time is not yet ripe, and to strike fiercely when it has reached fruition. Observance of the Law. Starting out in life as a nondescript French seminary school teacher, Joseph Fouché wandered from town to town for most of the decade of the 1780s, teaching mathematics to young boys. Yet he never completely committed himself to the church, never took his vows as a priest. He had bigger plans. Patiently waiting for his chance, he kept his options open. And when the French Revolution broke out in 1789, Fouché waited no longer. He got rid of his cassock, grew his hair long, and became a revolutionary. For this was the spirit of the times. To miss the boat at this critical moment could have spelt disaster. Fouché did not miss the boat. Befriending the revolutionary leader, Robespierre, he quickly rose in the rebel ranks. In 1792, the town of Nantes elected Fouché to be its representative to the National Convention, created that year to frame a new constitution for a French republic. When Fouché arrived in Paris to take his seat at the convention, a violent rift had broken out between the moderates and the radical Jacobins. Fouché sensed that in the long run, neither side would emerge victorious. Power rarely ends up in the hands of those who start a revolution, or even of those who further it. Power sticks to those who bring it to a conclusion. That was the side Fouché wanted to be on. His sense of timing was uncanny. He started as a moderate, for moderates were in the majority. When the time came to decide on whether or not to execute Louis XVI, however, he saw that the people were clamoring for the king's head. So he cast the deciding vote for the guillotine. Now he had become a radical. Yet as tensions came to the boil in Paris, he foresaw the danger of being too closely associated with any one faction. So he accepted a position in the provinces, where he could lie low for a while. A few months later, he was assigned to the post of proconsul in Lyon, where he oversaw the execution of dozens of aristocrats. At a certain moment, however, he called a halt to the killings, sensing that the mood of the country was turning. And despite the blood already on his hands, the citizens of Lyon hailed him as a savior from what had become known as the Terror. So far, Fouché had played his cards brilliantly. But in 1794, his old friend Robespierre recalled him to Paris to account for his actions in Lyon. Robespierre had been the driving force behind the Terror. He had sent heads on both the right and the left rolling, and Fouché, whom he no longer trusted, seemed destined to provide the next head. Over the next few weeks, a tense struggle ensued. While Robespierre railed openly against Fouché, accusing him of dangerous ambitions and calling for his arrest, the crafty Fouché worked more indirectly, quietly gaining support among those who were beginning to tire of Robespierre's dictatorial control. Fouché was playing for time. He knew that the longer he survived, the more disaffected citizens he could rally against Robespierre. He had to have broad support before he moved against the powerful leader. He rallied support among both the moderates and the Jacobins, playing on the widespread fear of Robespierre. Everyone was afraid of being the next to go to the guillotine. It all came to fruition on July 27th. The convention turned against Robespierre, shouting down his usual lengthy speech. He was quickly arrested, and a few days later it was Robespierre's head, not Fouché's, that fell into the basket. When Fouché returned to the convention after Robespierre's death, he played his most unexpected move. Having led the conspiracy against Robespierre, he was expected to sit with the moderates. But lo and behold, he once again changed sides, joining the radical Jacobins. For perhaps the first time in his life, he aligned himself with the minority. Clearly, he sensed a reaction stirring. He knew that the moderate faction that had executed Robespierre, and was now about to take power, would initiate a new round of the terror, this time against the radicals. In siding with the Jacobins, then, Fouché was sitting with the martyrs of the days to come, the people who would be considered blameless in the troubles that were on their way. Taking sides with what was about to become the losing team was a risky gambit, of course. But Fouché must have calculated he could keep his head long enough to quietly stir up the populace against the moderates and watch them fall from power. And indeed, although the moderates did call for his arrest in December of 1795 and would have sent him to the guillotine, too much time had passed. The executions had become unpopular with the people, and Fouché survived the swing of the pendulum one more time. A new government took over, the Directoire. It was not, however, a Jacobin government, but a moderate one. More moderate than the government that had reimposed the terror. Fouché, the radical, had kept his head, but now he had to keep a low profile. He waited patiently on the sidelines for several years, allowing time to soften any bitter feelings against him. Then he approached the Directoire and convinced them he had a new passion, intelligence gathering. He became a paid spy for the government, excelled at the job, and in 1799 was rewarded by being made Minister of Police. Now he was not just empowered, but required to extend his spying to every corner of France, a responsibility that would greatly reinforce his natural ability to sniff out where the wind was blowing. One of the first social trends he detected, in fact, came in the person of Napoleon, a brash young general whose destiny he right away saw was entwined with the future of France. When Napoleon unleashed a coup d'état on November 9, 1799, Fouché pretended to be asleep. Indeed, he slept the whole day. For this indirect assistance, it might have been thought his job, after all, to prevent a military coup, Napoleon kept him on as Minister of Police in the new regime. Over the next few years, Napoleon came to rely on Fouché more and more. He even gave this former revolutionary a title, Duke of Otranto, and rewarded him with great wealth. By 1808, however, Fouché, always attuned to the times, sensed that Napoleon was on the downswing. His futile war with Spain, a country that posed no threat to France, was a sign that he was losing a sense of proportion. Never one to be caught on a sinking ship, Fouché conspired with Talleyrand to bring about Napoleon's downfall. Although the conspiracy failed, Talleyrand was fired, Fouché stayed but was kept on a tight leash, it publicized a growing discontent with the emperor, who seemed to be losing control. By 1814, Napoleon's power had crumbled, and Allied forces finally conquered him. The next government was a restoration of the monarchy, in the form of King Louis XVIII, brother of Louis XVI. Fouché, his nose always sniffing the air for the next social shift, knew Louis would not last long. He had none of Napoleon's flair. Fouché once again played his waiting game, lying low, staying away from the spotlight. Sure enough, in February of 1815, Napoleon escaped from the island of Elba, where he had been imprisoned. Louis XVIII panicked. His policies had alienated the citizenry, who were clamoring for Napoleon's return. So Louis turned to the one man who could maybe have saved his hide, Fouché, the former radical, who had sent his brother Louis XVI to the guillotine, but was now one of the most popular and widely admired politicians in France. Fouché, however, would not side with a loser. He refused Louis's request for help by pretending that his help was unnecessary, by swearing that Napoleon would never return to power, although he knew otherwise. A short time later, of course, Napoleon and his new citizen army were closing in on Paris. Seeing his reign about to collapse, feeling that Fouché had betrayed him, and certain that he did not want this powerful and able man on Napoleon's team, King Louis ordered the minister's arrest and execution. On March 16, 1815, policemen surrounded Fouché's coach on a Paris boulevard. Was this finally his end? Perhaps, but not immediately. Fouché told the police that an ex-member of government could not be arrested on the street. They fell for the story and allowed him to return home. Later that day, though, they came to his house and once again declared him under arrest. Fouché nodded. But would the officers be so kind as to allow a gentleman to wash and to change his clothes before leaving his house for the last time? They gave their permission. Fouché left the room, and the minutes went by. Fouché did not return. Finally, the policeman went into the next room, where they saw a ladder against an open window leading down to the garden below. That day and the next, the police combed Paris for Fouché, but by then Napoleon's cannons were audible in the distance, and the king and all the king's men had to flee the city. As soon as Napoleon entered Paris, Fouché came out of hiding. He had cheated the executioner once again. Napoleon greeted his former minister of police and gladly restored him to his old post. During the 100 days that Napoleon remained in power until Waterloo, it was essentially Fouché who governed France. After Napoleon fell, Louis XVIII returned to the throne, and, like a cat with 9 lives, Fouché stayed on to serve in yet another government. By then, his power and influence had grown so great that not even the king dared challenge him. Interpretation. In a period of unprecedented turmoil, Joseph Fouché thrived through his mastery of the art of timing. He teaches us a number of key lessons. First, it is critical to recognize the spirit of the times. Fouché always looked 2 steps ahead, found the wave that would carry him to power, and rode it. You must always work with the times, anticipate twists and turns, and never miss the boat. Sometimes the spirit of the times is obscure. Recognize it not by what is loudest and most obvious in it, but by what lies hidden and dormant. Look forward to the Napoleons of the future, rather than holding on to the ruins of the past. Second, recognizing the prevailing winds does not necessarily mean running with them. Any potent social movement creates a powerful reaction, and it is wise to anticipate what that reaction will be, as Fouché did after the execution of Robespierre. Rather than ride the cresting wave of the moment, wait for the tide's ebb to carry you back to power. Upon occasion, bet on the reaction that is brewing, and place yourself in the vanguard of it. Finally, Fouché had remarkable patience. Without patience as your sword and shield, your timing will fail, and you will inevitably find yourself a loser. When the times were against Fouché, he didn't struggle, get emotional, or strike out rashly. He kept his cool and maintained a low profile, patiently building support among the citizenry, a bulwark in his next rise to power. Whenever he found himself in the weaker position, he played for time, which he knew would always be his ally if he was patient. Recognize the moment, then, to hide in the grass or slither under a rock, as well as the moment to bare your fangs and attack. As Napoleon said, "Space we can recover. Time never." Keys to power. Time is an artificial concept that we ourselves have created to make the limitlessness of eternity and the universe more bearable, more human. Since we have constructed this concept of time, we are also able to mold it to some degree, to play tricks with it. The time of a child is long and slow, with vast expanses. The time of an adult whizzes by frighteningly fast. Time, then, depends on perception, which we know can be willfully altered. This is the first thing to understand in mastering the art of timing. If the inner turmoil caused by our emotions tends to make time move faster, it follows that once we control our emotional responses to events, time will move much more slowly. This altered way of dealing with things tends to lengthen our perception of future time, opens up possibilities that fear and anger close off, and allows us the patience that is the principal requirement in the art of timing. There are 3 kinds of time for us to deal with. Each presents problems that can be solved with skill and practice. First, there is long time, the drawn-out, years-long kind of time that must be managed with patience and gentle guidance. Our handling of long time should be mostly defensive. This is the art of not reacting impulsively, of waiting for opportunity. Next, there is forced time, the short-term time that we can manipulate as an offensive weapon, upsetting the timing of our opponents. Finally, there is end time, when a plan must be executed with speed and force. We have waited, found the moment, and must not hesitate. Long time. The famous 17th-century Ming painter Chou Yung relates a story that altered his behavior forever. Late one winter afternoon, he set out to visit a town that lay across the river from his own town. He was bringing some important books and papers with him, and had commissioned a young boy to help him carry them. As the ferry neared the other side of the river, Chou Yung asked the boatman if they would have time to get to the town before its gates closed, since it was a mile away and night was approaching. The boatman glanced at the boy and at the bundle of loosely tied papers and books, Yes, he replied, if you do not walk too fast. As they started out, however, the sun was setting. Afraid of being locked out of the town at night, prey to local bandits, Cho and the boy walked faster and faster, finally breaking into a run. Suddenly the string around the papers broke and the documents scattered on the ground. It took them many minutes to put the packet together again, and by the time they had reached the city gates, it was too late. When you force the pace out of fear and impatience, you create a nest of problems that require fixing, and you end up taking much longer than if you had taken your time. Hurriers may occasionally get there quicker, but papers fly everywhere, new dangers arise, and they find themselves in constant crisis mode, fixing the problems that they themselves have created. Sometimes not acting in the face of danger is your best move. You wait. You deliberately slow down. As time passes, it will eventually present opportunities you had not imagined. Waiting involves controlling not only your own emotions, but those of your colleagues, who, mistaking action for power, may try to push you into making rash moves. In your rivals, on the other hand, you can encourage this same mistake. If you let them rush headlong into trouble while you stand back and wait, you will soon find right moments to intervene and pick up the pieces. This wise policy was the principal strategy of the great early 17th century emperor Tokugawa Ieyasu of Japan. When his predecessor, the headstrong Hideyoshi, whom he served as a general, staged a rash invasion of Korea, Ieyasu did not involve himself. He knew the invasion would be a disaster and would lead to Hideyoshi's downfall. Better to stand patiently on the sidelines, even for many years, and then be in a position to seize power when the time is right. Exactly what Ieyasu did with great artistry. You do not deliberately slow time down to live longer or to take more pleasure in the moment, but the better to play the game of power. First, when your mind is uncluttered by constant emergencies, you will see further into the future. Second, you will be able to resist the baits that people dangle in front of you, and will keep yourself from becoming another impatient sucker. Third, you will have more room to be flexible. Opportunities will inevitably arise that you had not expected, and would have missed had you forced the pace. Fourth, you will not be able to move from one deal to the next without completing the first one. To build your power's foundation can take years. Make sure that foundation is secure. Do not be a flash in the pan. Success that is built up slowly and surely is the only kind that lasts. Finally, slowing down time will give you a perspective on the times you live in. Letting you take a certain distance and putting you in a less emotionally charged position to see the shapes of things to come. Hurriers will often mistake surface phenomena for a real trend, seeing only what they want to see. How much better to see what is really happening, even if it is unpleasant or makes your task harder. Forced time. The trick in forcing time is to upset the timing of others, to make them hurry, to make them wait, to make them abandon their own pace, to distort their perception of time. By upsetting the timing of your opponent while you stay patient, you open up time for yourself, which is half the game. In 1473, the great Turkish Sultan Mehmet the Conqueror invited negotiations with Hungary to end the off-and-on war the two countries had waged for years. When the Hungarian emissary arrived in Turkey to start the talks, Turkish officials humbly apologized. Mehmet had just left Istanbul, the capital, to battle his longtime foe, Uzun Kasan. But he urgently wanted peace with Hungary, and had asked that the emissary join him at the front. When the emissary arrived at the site of the fighting, Mehmet had already left it, moving eastward in pursuit of his swift foe. This happened several times. Wherever the emissary stopped, the Turks lavished gifts and banquets on him, in pleasurable but time-consuming ceremonies. Finally, Mehmet defeated Uzun and met with the emissary. Yet his terms for peace with Hungary were excessively harsh. After a few days, the negotiations ended, and the usual stalemate remained in place. But this was fine with Mehmet. In fact, he had planned it that way all along. Plotting his campaign against Uzun, he had seen that diverting his armies to the east would leave his western flank vulnerable. To prevent Hungary from taking advantage of his weakness and his preoccupation elsewhere, he first dangled the lure of peace before his enemy, then made him wait, all on his own terms. Making people wait is a powerful way of forcing time, as long as they don't figure out what you're up to. You control the clock, they linger in limbo, and rapidly come unglued, opening up opportunities for you to strike. The opposite effect is equally powerful. You make your opponents hurry. Start off your dealings with them slowly, then suddenly apply pressure, making them feel that everything is happening at once. People who lack the time to think will make mistakes, so set their deadlines for them. This was the technique Machiavelli admired in Cesare Borgia, who, during negotiations, would suddenly press vehemently for a decision, upsetting his opponent's timing and patience. For who would dare make Cesare wait? Joseph Duveen, the famous art dealer, knew that if he gave an indecisive buyer like John D. Rockefeller a deadline, the painting had to leave the country. Another tycoon was interested in it. The client would buy just in time. Freud noticed that patients who had spent years in psychoanalysis without improvement would miraculously recover just in time if he fixed a definite date for the end of the therapy. Jacques Lacan, the famous French psychoanalyst, used a variation on this tactic. He would sometimes end the customary hour session of therapy after only 10 minutes, without warning. After this happened several times, the patient would realize that he had better make maximum use of the time, rather than wasting much of the hour with a lot of talk that meant nothing. The deadline, then, is a powerful tool. Close off the vistas of indecision and force people to make up their damn minds or get to the point. Never let them make you play on their excruciating terms. Never give them time. Magicians and showmen are experts in forcing time. Houdini could often wriggle free of handcuffs in minutes, but he would draw the escape out to an hour, making the audience sweat as time came to an apparent standstill. Magicians have always known that the best way to alter our perception of time is often to slow down the pace. Creating suspense brings time to a terrifying pause. The slower the magician's hands move, the easier it is to create the illusion of speed, making people think the rabbit has appeared instantaneously. The great 19th-century magician, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin, took explicit notice of this effect. "The more slowly a story is told," he said, "the shorter it seems." Going slower also makes what you are doing more interesting. The audience yields to your pace, becomes entranced. It is a state in which time whizzes delightfully by. You must practice such illusions, which share in the hypnotist's power to alter perceptions of time. End time. You can play the game with the utmost artistry, waiting patiently for the right moment to act, putting your competitors off their form by messing with their timing. But it won't mean a thing unless you know how to finish. Do not be one of those people who look like paragons of patience, but are actually just afraid to bring things to a close. Patience is worthless unless combined with a willingness to fall ruthlessly on your opponent at the right moment. You can wait as long as necessary for the conclusion to come, but when it comes, it must come quickly. Use speed to paralyze your opponent, cover up any mistakes you might make, and impress people with your aura of authority and finality. With the patience of a snake charmer, you draw the snake out with calm and steady rhythms. Once the snake is out, though, would you dangle your foot above its deadly head? There is never a good reason to allow the slightest hitch in your endgame. Your mastery of timing can really only be judged by how you work with end time, how you quickly change the pace and bring things to a swift and definitive conclusion. Reversal. There is no power to be gained in letting go of the reins and adapting to whatever time brings. To some degree, you must guide time, or you will be its merciless victim. There is, accordingly, no reversal to this law. Here are some further reflections on this law. From the Life of Sertorius by Plutarch. Sertorius's lesson. Sertorius's strength was now rapidly increasing, for all the tribes between the Ebro and the Pyrenees came over to his side, and troops came flocking daily to join him from every quarter. At the same time, he was troubled by the lack of discipline and the overconfidence of these newly arrived barbarians who had shouted him to attack the enemy and had no patience with his delaying tactics, and he therefore tried to win them over by argument. But when he saw that they were discontented and persisted in pressing their demands regardless of the circumstances, he let them have their way and allowed them to engage the enemy. He hoped that they would suffer a severe defeat without being completely crushed, and that this would make them better disposed to obey his orders in future. The event turned out as he expected, and Sertorius came to their rescue, provided a rallying point for their fugitives, and led them safely back to his camp. His next step was to revive their dejected spirits, and so a few days later he summoned a general assembly. Before it, he produced two horses, one of them old and enfeebled, the other large and lusty, and possessing a flowing tail, which was remarkable for the thickness and beauty of its hair. By the side of the weak horse stood a tall, strong man, and by the side of the powerful horse a short man of mean physique. At a signal, the strong man seized the tail of his horse and tried with all his strength to pull it towards him, as if to tear it off, while the weak man began to pull the hairs one by one from the tail of the strong horse. The strong man, after tugging with all his might to no purpose, and causing the spectators a great deal of amusement in the process, finally gave up the attempt, while the weak man quickly and with very little trouble stripped his horse's tail completely bare. Then Sertorius rose to his feet and said, "Now you can see, my friends and allies, that perseverance is more effective than brute strength, and that there are many difficulties that cannot be overcome if you try to do everything at once, but which will yield if you master them little by little. The truth is that a steady, continuous effort is irresistible, for this is the way in which time captures and subdues the greatest powers on earth. Now time, you should remember, is a good friend and ally to those who use their intelligence to choose the right moment, but a most dangerous enemy to those who rush into action at the wrong one." From Lao Tzu, quoted in the Chinese Looking Glass. Mr. Shi had two sons. One loved learning, the other war. The first expounded his moral teachings at the admiring court of Qi, and was made a tutor, while the second talked strategy at the bellicose court of Chu, and was made a general. The impecunious Mr. Meng, hearing of these successes, sent his own two sons out to follow the examples of the Chu boys. The first expounded his moral teachings at the court of Qin, but the king of Qin said, "At present the states are quarreling violently, and every prince is busy arming his troops to the teeth. If I follow this prig's pratings, we should soon be annihilated." So he had the fellow castrated. Meanwhile, the second brother displayed his military genius at the court of Wei. But the king of Wei said, "Mine is a weak state. If I relied on force instead of diplomacy, we should soon be wiped out. If, on the other hand, I let this fire-eater go, he will offer his services to another state, and then we shall be in trouble." So he had the fellow's feet cut off. Both families did exactly the same thing, but one timed it right, the other wrong. Thus, success depends not on ratiocination, but on rhythm. From The Craft of Power, by R.G.H. Sue. The Sultan of Persia had sentenced two men to death. One of them, knowing how much the Sultan loved his stallion, offered to teach the horse to fly within a year in return for his life. The Sultan, fancying himself as the rider of the only flying horse in the world, agreed. The other prisoner looked at his friend in disbelief. "You know horses don't fly. What made you come up with a crazy idea like that? You're only postponing the inevitable." "Not so," said the first prisoner. "I have actually given myself four chances for freedom. First, the Sultan might die during the year. Second, I might die. Third, the horse might die. And fourth, I might teach the horse to fly. From Fables by Robert Dodsley. The Trout and the Gudgeon. A fisherman in the month of May stood angling on the bank of the Thames with an artificial fly. He threw his bait with so much art that a young trout was rushing toward it, when she was prevented by her mother. "Never," said she, "my child, be too precipitate, where there is a possibility of danger. Take due time to consider before you risk an action that may be fatal. How know you whether yon appearance be indeed a fly, or the snare of an enemy? Let someone else make the experiment before you. If it be a fly, he will very probably elude the first attack, and the second may be made, if not with success, at least with safety." She had no sooner spoken than a gudgeon seized the pretended fly and became an example to the giddy daughter of the importance of her mother's counsel. The 36th Law. Disdain things you cannot have. Ignoring them is the best revenge. Judgment. By acknowledging a petty problem, you give it existence and credibility. The more attention you pay an enemy, the stronger you make him. And a small mistake is often made worse and more visible when you try to fix it. It is sometimes best to leave things alone. If there is something you want but cannot have, show contempt for it. The less interest you reveal, the more superior you seem. Transgression of the law. The Mexican rebel leader Pancho Villa started out as the chief of a gang of bandits. But after revolution broke out in Mexico in 1910, he became a kind of folk hero, robbing trains and giving the money to the poor, leading daring raids and charming the ladies with romantic escapades. His exploits fascinated Americans. He seemed a man from another era, part Robin Hood, part Don Juan. After a few years of bitter fighting, however, General Carranza emerged as the victor in the revolution. The defeated Villa and his troops went back home to the northern state of Chihuahua. His army dwindled, and he turned to banditry again, damaging his popularity. Finally, perhaps out of desperation, he began to rail against the United States, the gringos, whom he blamed for his troubles. In March of 1916, Pancho Villa raided Columbus, New Mexico. Rampaging through the town, he and his gang killed 17 American soldiers and civilians. President Woodrow Wilson, like many Americans, had admired Villa. Now, however, the bandit needed to be punished. Wilson's advisors urged him to send troops into Mexico to capture Villa. For a power as large as the United States, they argued, not to strike back at an army that had invaded its territory would send the worst kind of signal. Furthermore, they continued, many Americans saw Wilson as a pacifist, a principle the public doubted as a response to violence. He needed to prove his mettle and manliness by ordering the use of force. The pressure on Wilson was strong, and before the month was out, with the approval of the Carranza government, he sent an army of 10,000 soldiers to capture Pancho Villa. The venture was called the Punitive Expedition, and its leader was the dashing General John J. Pershing, who had defeated guerrillas in the Philippines and Native Americans in the American Southwest. Certainly Pershing could find and overpower Pancho Villa. The Punitive Expedition became a sensational story, and carloads of U.S. reporters followed Pershing into action. The campaign, they wrote, would be a test of American power. The soldiers carried the latest in weaponry, communicated by radio, and were supported by reconnaissance from the air. In the first few months, the troops split up into small units to comb the wilds of northern Mexico. The Americans offered a $50,000 reward for information leading to Villa's capture. But the Mexican people, who had been disillusioned with Villa when he had returned to banditry, now idolized him for facing this mighty American army. They began to give Pershing false leads. Villa had been seen in this village or in that mountain hideaway. Airplanes would be dispatched, troops would scurry after them, and no one would ever see him. The wily bandit seemed to be always one step ahead of the American military. By the summer of that year, the expedition had swelled to 123,000 men. They suffered through the stultifying heat, the mosquitoes, the wild terrain. Trudging over a countryside in which they were already resented, they infuriated both the local people and the Mexican government. At one point, Pancho Villa hid in a mountain cave to recover from a gunshot wound he received in a skirmish with the Mexican army. Looking down from his aerie, he could watch Pershing lead the exhausted American troops back and forth across the mountains, never getting any closer to their goal. All the way into winter, Villa played his cat-and-mouse game. Americans came to see the affair as a kind of slapstick farce. In fact, they began to admire Villa again, respecting his resourcefulness in eluding a superior force. In January of 1917, Wilson finally ordered Pershing's withdrawal. As the troops made their way back to American territory, rebel forces pursued them, forcing the U.S. Army to use airplanes to protect its rear flanks. The punitive expedition was being punished itself. It had turned into a retreat of the most humiliating sort. Interpretation. Woodrow Wilson organized the punitive expedition as a show of force. He would teach Pancho Villa a lesson, and in the process show the world that no one, large or small, could attack the mighty United States and get away with it. The expedition would be over in a few weeks, and Villa would be forgotten. That was not how it played out. The longer the expedition took, the more it focused attention on the Americans' incompetence and on Villa's cleverness. Soon what was forgotten was not Villa, but the raid that had started it all. As a minor annoyance became an international embarrassment, and the enraged Americans dispatched more troops, the imbalance between the size of the pursuer and the size of the pursued, who still managed to stay free, made the affair a joke. And in the end, this white elephant of an army had to lumber out of Mexico humiliated. The punitive expedition did the opposite of what it set out to do. It left Villa not only free, but more popular than ever. What could Wilson have done differently? He could have pressured the Carranza government to catch Villa for him. Alternatively, since many Mexicans had tired of Villa before the punitive expedition began, he could have worked quietly with them and won their support for a much smaller raid to capture the bandit. He could have organized a trap on the American side of the border, anticipating the next raid. Or he could have ignored the matter altogether for the time being, waiting for the Mexicans themselves to do away with Villa of their own accord. Remember, you choose to let things bother you. You can just as easily choose to not notice the irritating offender, to consider the matter trivial and unworthy of your interest. That is a powerful move. What you do not react to cannot drag you down in a futile engagement. Your pride is not involved. The best lesson you can teach an irritating gnat is to consign it to oblivion by ignoring it. If it is impossible to ignore, Pancho Villa had in fact killed American citizens, then conspire in secret to do away with it, but never inadvertently draw attention to the bothersome insect that will go away or die on its own. If you waste time and energy in such entanglements, it is your own fault. Learn to play the card of disdain, and turn your back on what cannot harm you in the long run. As Pancho Villa said, just think, it cost your government $130 million to try to get me. I took them over rough, hilly country. Sometimes for 50 miles at a stretch they had no water. They had nothing but the sun and mosquitoes, and nothing was gained. Observance of the law. In the year 1527, King Henry VIII of England decided he had to find a way to get rid of his wife, Catherine of Aragon. Catherine had failed to produce a son, a male heir, who would ensure the continuance of his dynasty. And Henry thought he knew why. He had read in the Bible the passage, "And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless." Before marrying Henry, Catherine had married his older brother, Arthur. But Arthur had died 5 months later. Henry had waited an appropriate time, then had married his brother's widow. Catherine was the daughter of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain. And by marrying her, Henry had kept alive a valuable alliance. Now, however, Catherine had to assure him that her brief marriage with Arthur had never been consummated. Otherwise, Henry would view their relationship as incestuous, and their marriage as null and void. Catherine insisted that she had remained a virgin through her marriage to Arthur, and Pope Clement VII supported her by giving his blessing to the union, which he could not have done had he considered it incestuous. Yet after years of marriage to Henry, Catherine had failed to produce a son, and in the early 1520s she had entered menopause. To the king this could only mean one thing. She had lied about her virginity. Their union was incestuous, and God had punished them. There was another reason why Henry wanted to get rid of Catherine. He had fallen in love with a younger woman, Anne Boleyn. Not only was he in love with her, but if he married her, he could still hope to sire a legitimate son. The marriage to Catherine had to be annulled. For this, however, Henry had to apply to the Vatican. But Pope Clement would never annul the marriage. By the summer of 1527, rumors spread throughout Europe that Henry was about to attempt the impossible, to annul his marriage against Clement's wishes. Catherine would never abdicate, let alone voluntarily enter a nunnery, as Henry had urged her. But Henry had his own strategy. He stopped sleeping in the same bed with Catherine, since he considered her his sister-in-law, not his lawful wife. He insisted on calling her Princess Dowager of Wales, her title as Arthur's widow. Finally, in 1531, he banished her from court and shipped her off to a distant castle. The Pope ordered him to return her to court on pain of excommunication, the most severe penalty a Catholic could suffer. Henry not only ignored this threat, he insisted that his marriage to Catherine had been dissolved, and in 1533 he married Anne Boleyn. Clement refused to recognize the marriage, but Henry did not care. He no longer recognized the Pope's authority, and proceeded to break with the Roman Catholic Church, establishing the Church of England in its stead, with the king as the head of the new church. And so, not surprisingly, the newly formed Church of England proclaimed Anne Boleyn England's rightful queen. The Pope tried every threat in the book, but nothing worked. Henry simply ignored him. Clement fumed. No one had ever treated him so contemptuously. Henry had humiliated him, and he had no power of recourse. Even excommunication, which he constantly threatened but never carried out, would no longer matter. Catherine, too, felt the devastating sting of Henry's disdain. She tried to fight back, but in appealing to Henry, her words fell on deaf ears, and soon they fell on no one's. Isolated from the court, ignored by the king, mad with anger and frustration, Catherine slowly deteriorated, and finally died in January of 1536 from a cancerous tumor of the heart. Interpretation. When you pay attention to a person, the two of you become partners of sorts, each moving in step to the actions and reactions of the other. In the process, you lose your initiative. It is the dynamic of all interactions. By acknowledging other people, even if only to fight with them, you open yourself to their influence. Had Henry locked horns with Catherine, he would have found himself mired in endless arguments that would have weakened his resolve and eventually worn him down. Catherine was a strong, stubborn woman. Had he set out to convince Clement to change his verdict on the marriage validity, or tried to compromise and negotiate with him, he would have gotten bogged down in Clement's favorite tactic, playing for time, promising flexibility, but actually getting what popes always got, their way. Henry would have none of this. He played a devastating power game. Total disdain. By ignoring people, you cancel them out. This unsettles and infuriates them. But since they have no dealings with you, there's nothing they can do. This is the offensive aspect of the law. Playing the card of contempt is immensely powerful, for it lets you determine the conditions of the conflict. The war is waged on your terms. This is the ultimate power pose. You are the king, and you ignore what offends you. Watch how this tactic infuriates people. Half of what they do is to get your attention, and when you withhold it from them, they flounder in frustration. As Idris Shaw says in Caravan of Dreams, "Man, kick him, he'll forgive you. Flatter him, he may or may not see through you. But ignore him, and he'll hate you." Keys to power. Desire often creates paradoxical effects. The more you want something, the more you chase after it, the more it eludes you. The more interest you show, the more you repeat.